The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Old tech, new tricks. It's not just NVIDIA taking the market to record highs. From Oracle to Dell to IBM, some of technology's old guard are in rally mode this year. What does this resurgence say about the strength of the market rally? We'll dig in. Plus, China rising. The FXI has rallied nearly 20% since hitting 15-year lows in January. Is this just the start of a real rebound in the region? We'll talk to one top investor to find out. And a big bank breakout, shares of long beleaguered Deutsche Bank suddenly hitting 2+ year highs. Is there more room for the name to run? One of our traders lays out the case. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Courtney Garcia, Dan Nathan, and Guy Adami. And on a day when the S&P sets yet another new record, it was the index's top two performers that caught our eyes, Oracle and NVIDIA, both surging and highlighting strength across generations of big tech. Oracle's pop after earnings last night, bringing its gains for the year to more than 20%. And it's not the only veteran in rally mode. Dell, HPE, IBM, all trading at or near all-time highs. But the recent tech darlings didn't get left behind either today. After a two-day pause, NVIDIA jumping more than 7%, closing just off its record high. Meta also recouping much of yesterday's losses. So is this a case of in with the old, in with the new, too, Guy?
I like that. You write that? That's very good. Apparently so. And again, we play this game a lot. But, you know, with the move in the bond yields today up to now 4.15, if you even told me last night what's going to happen to these stocks, I'm like, they're all going to sell off, especially given the reversal we saw in a lot of these names on Friday. Clearly that didn't happen. However, to answer your question, you know, one thing I think we've done a good job on are these old tech names. We had Ben Reitzes on this show, I think, on March 4th. He talked about Dell. You know, the good news there is that stock's come off from 131 down to current levels. You know, I think that's a stock you want to absolutely take a look at. But IBM, we've been steadfast. Sandy Canold, our great senior executive producer. Yes. I think that was the I in his anagram, or what do they call the thing?
Acronym,
right, last year. So kudos for him. But we've been talking about that for a while. So old tech is actually a place where you can rationalize valuation for a lot of those names as opposed to some of these other high flyers.
There's also an AI undercurrent also to all of these quote-unquote old tech names that are playing sort of a catch-up game at this point, Courtney.
Absolutely. And AI has, you know, NVIDIA has been the big winner there. But what people need to realize is you're going to need hardware. Like, if we actually want to use AI, you need a device that's enabled with AI in order to use it. And that's where something like an HP or a Dell is going to come back in favor here, right? Because after the pandemic, everyone got their computers, but it takes about a three-year cycle for everyone to get new ones. So just in general, people need new computers, but in general, over the next decade, you're going to need those AI-enabled ones. So I love this old-school hardware technology play. I think is absolutely here to stay.
Guy cycle those 15 years.
So wait, you're talking about a PC refresh recycle, Tim. You heard that one before?
Somewhere, but, you know,
super cycle
it seems
and AI
to work somehow.
Yeah, I'm just saying. I mean, like, listen, I get what you're saying, too, and that is going to be the next iteration of this trend, right? So everybody needed the GPUs. That's why all these semiconductors have gone this way. What Dell and what Oracle and what the hyperscalers and all these folks are telling you, it is a verticalized, you know, sort of operation here. At some point, though, I would just expect that demand kind of gets, you know, settles out a little bit. There was an article in The Information early this morning, starting the day, talking about how Google and some of these other cloud players are kind of tamping down expectations for the commercialization of some of these products. I think that is going to be a story that clearly hits the tech market at some point this year. And that is a story about expectations. And it's a story about how excited people are about some very crowded investments. But again, on a day like today, when you saw the reversal on Friday of some of these semi names, the kind of follow through we were talking about last night on the desk, I think we're all a little bit surprised that they didn't follow through a bit more. And to see NVIDIA come back the way it did, it tells you that they're just not done yet. You know, I mean, they're just not done yet coming for these names.
Well, I look at Oracle, and again, this is old tech. It's a company, though, that's transformed itself over the last few years. I mean, they really have. And they now, if you look at the strength of the numbers they put out yesterday, not only were they, like a lot of these companies, showing margin enhancement, more efficiency. Everybody's got the year of efficiency, by the way. See AI and see what really happens. I think that's part of the multiple here. But again, their core business is across two or three business lines, whether it's RPO, whether it's OCI, a lot of initials here. The OCI certainly gets you more into the AI space. And And I just think it gets back to a place where people are looking for the names that have multiples that they can get behind. We can question all day long, right or wrong, on what you want to pay for AMD or NVIDIA. But when it gets back to some of these older tech names, the valuations are a lot more, you know, palatable, if I may. And so there are a few tech names, by the way, I think it's also important to point out, really haven't been part of the party. Look at Cisco. I mean, Cisco's been kind of dead in the water. It hasn't been a disaster. But it's a case of, again, a company that's been slowly trying to transform itself. I happen to know this story because I'm long and it's really lagged in the software and security dynamic of their business, which is also high margin and recurring revenue and annuity dynamics, which help multiples, have really not gone so well. Intel, we talk about this name all the time. Not cheap, by the way, certainly on a multiple, maybe underowned, which is why I still own it. Not the only reason to own it, but I actually think that they're starting to come through on a product base. But it's a fascinating time. When I don't think that a lot of the market is all that expensive. And yet, if you look at the top of the tree, and those names are very expensive.
Well, I was just going to say Intel, too. And again, it's not that exciting. I mean, when they reported in late January, they missed. They guided lower. The stock gapped down 12% in one day. It's been kind of range bound here. And I think your point is a good one. It's expensive right now on current estimates. If those estimates start to go higher, because, again, you know, look at what Taiwan Semi, the beneficiary of the CHIPS Act, and building, you know, plants here in the U.S., reshoring is going to be a big theme. I know Guy has been talking about this. But if you just look at a name like Qualcomm, and we mentioned this a couple months ago, it, again, was a name. If PCs are not great, if handsets are not great, right? And you have to wait for a refresh cycle for AI to be on the devices or whatever. Well, Qualcomm just ran in front of it. So, like, you'd want to look at a name like Intel, where a lot of their end markets are not doing particularly well, but maybe they do have this manufacturing angle at some point this year, next, and the like, and should play catch up. But again, that only happens if this whole thing is broadening out a bit. And you guys have all made the case that it has, except for a handful of names.
Yeah, I think it is.
But, okay, here's a question.
Yeah.
1 year time frame, Intel or NVIDIA?
Probably Intel. I mean, to be honest with you, because I don't know how a company that can, like NVIDIA, that encapsulates, I think, so much of the excitement in and around this chip space and is clearly the beneficiary of all the orders, has gained $1 trillion in market cap in just 2 months, has gained $1.5 trillion market cap in, you know, 18 months. I mean, Intel's left for dead. I mean, that's where I would be putting my money right here if I had to do it.
Here's an interesting one later this week. Adobe, I think it's Thursday, they report. $250 billion company, had a huge run up into 21, fell off a cliff like everything else. People are going to start to talk about this as sort of an AI name. Have they figured it out? Reasonable valuation. Of course, the problem is it's had a huge run and it's historic for their, you know, earnings releases and then sell-offs after. But if Adobe can catch a bid, then maybe we are broadening out to the extent that everybody thinks.
But is that the name of the game? In order to broaden out, you have to be part of AI?
No. And I think, look at banks. Banks aren't part of AI. Look what's going on there. Look at industrials.
In technology, sorry.
Okay. Well, yes and no. I mean, we've seen a lot of software names that are just software names. I mean, software doesn't have to be AI software. Look at CrowdStrike. Look at a lot of the names that have had big, big days. And I think they've also followed high multiple stocks. That, to me, has been the progression. You followed semis, then you followed software, then you followed mega cap techs. But I are we done with tech? Because I just wanted to talk about something else.
No, what
do you want to talk about? Tim, you know, it's your show, you know.
Your time, Tim.
You're a key participant.
Well, I mean,
what's your agenda today?
You were asking me about tech, but Guy started bringing up interest rates and CPI.
I thought I was in trouble.
It's all tied in. I mean, if I told you
that's where I was going,
what the CPI print would be today, what would you think the market reaction would be? What do you think tech's reaction would be?
And I could have tied it back to tech. Maybe I was too honest here, Mel, but the point is that CPI number wasn't great for markets. Wow. And it was a fascinating day because rates went higher. I think we're still on a 2-year uptrend on long rates, by the way. Every time it tests the bottom end of that channel, I think it's bouncing. I think if you looked at what we got in terms of services inflation, what you got on owner's equivalent rent dynamics, I think June is 50-50. It was 75% to 80% a few weeks ago. And yet equities don't really seem to care. And that's what makes a day like today fascinating, because I think there are parts of the market that really love this dynamic. And I think banks are near the top of that list.
I mean, at what point should we start caring that maybe that rate cut is being priced out of June? And that you only have the back half of the year to get those accomplished.
Yeah, and I think we're going to need to see how the next couple reports come, because at this point in time, right, I mean, we did see an increase in CPI, which clearly the markets didn't care about because, A, I mean, it wasn't a huge increase, but you saw core inflation actually came down. Super core inflation actually also came down, which is a good thing. But one of these data points isn't going to make or break things. As much as we'd like inflation to come down and meet pretty lines, it just doesn't work like that. So having one or two data points coming up is not a problem. But if this continues to be a trend, absolutely. absolutely that would be a problem. I don't think we're there yet, neither do the market. So we're going to have to see over the next couple of months how it continues.
You know, it's again, we've stopped talking about the yield curve because clearly the market doesn't care. But Liz Young, who's on that great show, Halftime Report from time to time.
Also on some podcasts.
She is, actually, and that's an excellent point by you. But she does all the different CNBC shows except this one. But she tweeted earlier that, you know, today we've actually surpassed 79.80 in terms of longest duration of an inversion in the yield curve, which I think should matter. But clearly the market doesn't care. And at some point, again, it's the steepening where people should care. And we haven't gotten there. We got close, but we haven't gotten there. And here we sit at 45 basis points or so and seemingly off on our merry way in the market. I think there's more to it than that.
All right. Well, it's not just the U.S. China Internet stocks are also breaking out. The Crane Shares China Internet ETF jumping more than 7% so far this week. It's on track for its best week since last September when it gained almost 8%. The KWEB, which includes Alibaba and JD.com, now up almost 16% from its late January low. So is this momentum a sign a sustainable rebound is underway? Have we seen the worst in terms of the indices in China, do you think, Tim?
That's certainly how I've been positioning. Mm-hmm. And I've been positioning on some levels for this for maybe a year and a half. But I do think, especially when folks are allocating for, you know, 12, 15, 18 months, even not 2 years, the dynamics in China are really interesting. China as a global economy is structurally going through a change that we never expected they'd go through, even though that's what happens when your demographics are as poor as China's are. Yeah, I said that. It gets back to a place, though, that the multiple's pretty attractive. We've talked about the $80 billion of the $195 billion in market cap of Baba being in cash. We've talked about the positioning. And I just drill in on the positioning. The top global funds who have exposure to China historically, and again, that includes MSCI Global, are as underweight China as they've been in 10 years. And that's before the MSCI A shares were put in the index. In other words, they're below a level before a significant part of the index forced them to own China. There's nobody that owns this market. There's a lot of reasons for it. And I still don't feel like I can have high conviction that the government's my friend here. But I look at some of the big internet names in China, their version of the Mag 7, whatever we're doing, and they're interesting on a multi-year basis for sure.
It's Fab Four, bro. But I'll just say this. I think everything what Tim just said makes a lot of sense. If you think about how bad the data coming out of China is right now, and then you think about some of this export data that's been really good, right? I actually think you want to flip that narrative upside down a little bit. And so to me, everything we talked about last night about TikTok and the banning and the lack of our digital companies being able to be over there, I think that's the stuff that stays pretty murky for some time to come. And you mentioned President Xi and how he feels about their domestic champions. Well, they've already taken them out to the woodshed. So if I look at like a name like Baba, which is obviously very consumer focused, and obviously they don't want things to go pear-shaped, they've already gone bad enough. If there's one stock on my entire board that I think could double, okay, over the next year, it'd probably be Alibaba. I mean,
You put your B where your zebra was, well, by the way.
Thank you for remembering.
Right in the middle, smack dab in the middle of the zebra.
Dan's a little, he's a little self-conscious. Not self-conscious, he feels like his acronym doesn't get enough attention.
My
bicep gets a lot of attention.
And Guy's Clam is just, it's trending some nights. Yeah. You know, during the show.
I'm sure it's trending
all over the place. Real quick, if we can throw an FX side chart up, because we actually flagged this in late January. We said, you know what, folks, here's your opportunity. Got down to 21, same levels we saw, I think, October of 2022. Go back all the way. I think it was 08 the last time was down there. We said, this is it. The risk reward sets up well. Now, I know it hasn't exploded to the upside, but it's actually done okay. And I'm with the guys on Alibaba, and I'm sure Courtney feels the same way. I mean, this thing we've seen in a downtrend for 4 years, it's had 35 to 50% rallies probably 7 or 8 different times. And I think we're probably on the verge of one now.
Yeah, and I'm completely on board with that. I mean, we've really been making sure that we have a stake in emerging markets. And I think it's interesting because when you look at fund managers have been underweight China, we're definitely seeing that from investors, too. Like, actually, BlackRock came out and they did make an emerging market fund ex-China because people just aren't willing to go in there, even though they're on board with the idea of emerging markets. And it is a good portion of some of those funds. But I do think because of some of those risk rewards and because some of that sentiment, people are so out of it right now. And I think there's a lot of money that will eventually go back in. I do think you want to have a piece of that in your portfolio. Absolutely.
A leading emerging market analyst sees reasons for investors to dip their toes back into China. David Riedel runs Riedel Research Group and is a former Salomon Brothers analyst based in Asia. David, great to have you with us. I think what's not getting that much attention is what happened last week at the National People's Congress and the efforts that China might actually get accomplished to boost consumer spending, which could be huge for a lot of these stocks.
Absolutely. I think it's really gone under the radar that there is a generational change potentially in China where they are planning to liberalize or considering liberalizing what's called the household registration program. So all these hundreds of millions of migrant workers that live and work in the cities really live in the shadows. They can't own property. They can't send their kids to local schools. They can't access health care or any of the other social benefits because their household registration is actually back home in their little town in rural China. So they are talking about changing that, which would unleash a huge amount of consumer demand for household goods, for apartments, for all kinds of things. So I think that if China gets that right, it starts to become investable in a way that I don't think it has been in the last 5 or 10 years.
At this point, David, would you say that the Chinese government itself or the U.S. government is the bigger risk to China's stocks?
I think the U.S. has kind of taken itself a little bit out of that risk. They played a game of chicken with Beijing a couple years ago about audit and SEC and registrations and listings and so on and so forth, and China blinked. You know, China has been willing to inflict a lot of pain on their own market through the attacks on big tech and so on and so forth in the last few years. I think if Beijing backs away a little bit and gives people some confidence that they're not going to interfere, China could have been in for a multi-year run.
Hey, David, it's Tim. It's great to have you because, you know, you've caught different pieces of this. You were very bearish on China in October of 22. It's great to have you back on what looks like a pivot. And if there's anyone I'm listening to on EM, it's you. And so I get back to some of the technical dynamics. We've heard about China's version of the plunge protection team. Basically, their government's going in and buying ETFs and they're stimulating their market much in the same way we did here. What do you think about that? And I talked before about positioning for global investors. Big investors who, if they just change this much, are going to change, I think, the return profile of the asset class.
I think that's exactly right. But remember what China has going for it, right? They control 70% of their economy. They've got $3 trillion in reserves and building up their reserves all the time. So they've definitely got money to spend in Beijing to support different parts of the economy that they want to support. Let's not hope that they put their thumbs on the scale too much to really turn things over. But you're right. My clients have been out of China for years at this point. And I think some of them are starting to regret it, and they're starting to look at ways to get in. Where can I get comfortable with governance? Where can I get comfortable with valuation? Where can I get comfortable that Beijing's not going to insert themselves into an industry or into a company and upset the apple cart? If I can answer a few of those things in the affirmative, I've got a great opportunity to invest in China today.
David, I love your stemware. Geopolitical risk, South China Sea. I mean, what percentage do you put in terms of this thesis? You caught that, Mel, didn't you?
You know, you just look at the film from last week. Chinese maritime authorities shooting water cannons at a Philippine fishing vessel, blew out the windshield and injured 4 Filipino fishermen. It is just a hair's breadth away from someone getting killed on either side of one of these aggressive attacks by China on the Philippines, on Vietnam, on the Taiwan Straits. It's just too dangerous for them to be operating at this kind of velocity. I'm actually leaving for Taiwan on Thursday, so I'll be able to report back next week when I get back on how things are feeling on the ground there. But I think everyone needs to be super careful and not get trip into an inadvertent war in that region.
David, great to speak with you. Thank you. David Riedel, Riedel Research, not Riedel Stemware. And I think that's the first time Stemware was actually
I don't even know what Stemware is.
Oh, come on, Tim. Stop it. What? You know what Stemware is.
Glasses with stem.
Cabernet.
I don't drink a lot of wine. Maybe I'm really showing my boorish nature here. But
anyway,
sorry about Stemware.
Anyway, yeah. JD had great earnings. PDD got a big upgrade yesterday, huge advance. Where would you start here in China if you wanted a China stock?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're definitely playing the broad index, but I think that is what you're seeing with any of the individual companies. Late last year, even when you got some good news with these companies, it wasn't getting priced into the stock, but you're finally seeing that, right? I mean, good news is actually leading to higher prices, which means the momentum and the optimism has actually really shifted here, which is good news.
I'm just getting word. This is breaking news here.
Okay, yeah, you look excited about something.
That David Riedel's family is
Stop
somewhere.
It! Get out of here!
Yes,
that's unbelievable.
Somewhere.
So you see, you made fun of me.
Well,
meanwhile,
you did not know.
Yes, I did.
I did not know that. We just got this in.
And I'm the one that pointed out on TV that I don't have a lot of wine glasses, so I would assume I'm going to get a box of these things sent to me just because.
David's listening. I'm sure.
And I love David's work. I'll say this really quickly. Emerging markets, whether you're following the VWO or the EEM, because 40% of that's China, and you look at these indices, they're right up at the EEM is the 42 levels, the level it's been bucking up to for a year and a half. Remember the false breakout? Maybe it was a real breakout. When rates started going higher in May of 2000 and markets were going high, EM took off. And as a guy that's been in this asset class for 20 years, it's an interesting time. I was buying levered calls on the EEM earlier this week.
The more you know.
The more you know.
The more you know. Coming up, headwinds in the airline trade. Airlines losing altitude as continued problems at Boeing weigh on their travel plans, and some new reports on Alaska Air. That is next. Plus, has gold's run gotten out of hand? Some analysts souring on the precious metal after its record run, but two of our traders say it's not losing its luster just yet. More on that when Fast Money returns.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. We've got a news alert on Alaska Air. Some new reporting about that midair blowout in January. Phil LeBeau's got the details. Phil.
Melissa, this comes from the New York Times, which is citing documents and interviews regarding the incident back on January 5th. And according to the article posted by the Times just a few minutes ago, engineers at Alaska Airlines were so concerned about a couple of warning lights, times warning lights had gone off in the plane where the door plug eventually blew off, that they were scheduling a maintenance check for the evening after that plane finished its final flight. As we know, that flight is when the door plug came off. So the point of this being there had been concern about what was happening here. There had been allegedly complaints from passengers on previous flights about a whistling sound within the aircraft. We bring this up because it's all part of what we're noticing right now, Melissa, with whether it's the lawsuits, whether it's the investigations that are taking place. And there are at least three right now, the DOJ, the FAA and NTSB, looking at Boeing and its manufacturing process. All of this gets into the question of, should this have been flagged earlier, and should the manufacturing process have caught some of the problems that ultimately led to this door plug being blown out? So as you take a look at shares of Boeing, and I know you guys are going to talk about this in a little bit, today was the J.P. Morgan Transportation Conference. Heard from a number of CEOs, and time and again, one of the questions came up was, what are you going to do with your capacity this year and in the future? Because you're not going to be getting the planes you thought you were going to get from Boeing, or at least not as many. And as a result, a number of changes are going to have to be made by a number of airlines in terms of their future capacity plans.
Yep. Phil, thank you. Phil LeBeau. And among those airlines speaking at that conference, talking about capacity and reduced deliveries they will be getting, Southwest, which saw a huge decline in today's session, they're getting 46 versus 79 expected. So that's going to have a huge impact on their capacity plans.
Look at the last. OK, yes, let's go through it. And we say all the time Delta's the best. Actually, Delta higher today. I think it has room probably north of 46 bucks. It's been in this sort of 35, 49 range. So I think Delta's the place to be. Alaska Air, though, they gave guidance on March 12th. Better than expected. Lousy, but less lousy than expected. And if you want to play chart technician here, it's been in a very steep downtrend for the last 7 years. But you have these major double bottoms around 31 and a half, 32. And if it can get some giddy up off a day like today, when bad news no longer makes a stock go lower, and Tim can speak to this, when it goes from really bad to just poor, that's when these things start to move. So I think for a trade, Alaska Air looks really interesting here.
American Airlines, that was interesting because they said that they would be in the lower end of their loss range. But they cited, they didn't mention Boeing. They cited fuel costs and rising fuel costs. And we actually saw that as well. I think it was in the Southwest comments during the conference.
What's interesting, and unfortunately for airlines, and if you're an investor, airlines don't get credit for lower fuel prices, but they certainly lose ground on higher. They have hedges out there. Sometimes we find about them in the aftermath. I agree with Guy on Delta. I think even above 42, you're starting to break out. I think this is. I think airlines have been slow to the normalized economy dynamic, and they've been hampered, hindered by some of the Boeing dynamics, really, frankly, just global dynamics. But if you look at the Southwest performance, and obviously there's a lot of issues there. It's not just a Boeing issue. Even without Boeing, they have a loss, and they you know, their first quarter update kind of talked about revenue per available seat miles. That's
nice.
RASM. Yes, that's RASM. And there's many different acronyms within the airline revenue and cost base that all make, usually add up to one thing. Airlines are often not very efficient and running well above their cost base. And this is something that I think is a concern for the industry, especially if costs are going higher. I do think that the big three, with an emphasis on Delta, is where you want to be here. I wouldn't be chasing Southwest yet.
All right. There's a lot more fast money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Metal musings. Analysts saying gold's record run has gone too far, too fast. But a few of our traders beg to differ. Why they say gold could keep glistening. Plus, obesity drugs making waves this year. But could the new budget proposal tip the scales on this trade? What to watch as the weight loss drug race rages on. You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. After rallying more than 6% in the last month, gold bugs took a breather today, the precious metal settling down about 1% for its worst day since February 13th. That is after Barclays called the recent rally premature. In a note this morning, analysts pointing out gold has historically risen after, not before, the Fed's first rate cut, and for that reason is running ahead of itself. But two of our traders say, no, 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 we do not agree. Those traders being Tim and Guy. I'll start off with you, Guy, because you have two letters in your clan.
Yeah, excuse me.
That are leveraged.
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah.
Agnico Eagle. Well, the A.
What? The A.
Is a minor. The other ones have nothing to do, but that's fine. With that said, again, we've talked about, I don't know, there's no euphoria around the gold market. I mean, when you look at some of the nonsense or some of the zaniness that's going on in individual equities, I mean, that to me is a little extreme. I don't think we've gotten anywhere near extreme yet in gold. And again, we've mentioned how central banks have been buying at record amounts 2022, 2023, on par this year to do exactly the same thing. And at a certain price, when you start getting through levels that we haven't seen before, you're going to get institutional money that I don't think the market is fully prepared for. So I understand that it's rallied. I understand why it sold off today on the back of the bond move. But I think gold is resilient. I think it goes higher from here.
I also feel like knowing that gold typically rallies after a Fed pivot, you buy it before.
You do, but
you don't know when the pivot exactly is.
But this pivot is coming in different stages, and there's different pieces of it. We've got a Federal Reserve that's kind of telling you they're gaming the short end of the market. They're trying to flood the market with as many short-ended treasuries as possible. You combine that with comments from various Fed officials like Waller, who made some comments the other day on QE and what they're doing. And all of this is the fundamental story behind gold. Guys, dead on in terms of, you can't tell me gold's in a spec bubble. This has been going on slowly for a long time. If you look at open interest on the COMEX, and this is just one type of investor, but this is institutions and this is people that actually use gold, and in some cases, but many that speculate it, we're at record low open interest at the end of February for gold. So, you know, tell me that this is a place where there's a frothy, and again, guy was a trader of this metal, of the yellow metal at one point.
Among other things.
I've been following gold from the late 90s as an EM guy when a lot of the central bank buying stuff was happening. I give credit to Peter Schiff, who's been on this show for many times. We've had some fun little jousts, but he's been a gold bull, and I think some of his views are extreme. But this whole dynamic of where we are with the U.S. as a reserve currency and the Federal Reserve, et cetera, slowly, this is the reason to buy gold. Slowly.
Coming up, the latest on the weight loss drug space. Obesity drugs surging popularity this year, but could President Biden's new budget proposal slim down the gains for drug makers? The details next. And we're getting an exclusive look into the world of organized retail crime, the rise in theft, and the billions of dollars in losses. More on that when Fast Money returns.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks jumping after this morning's CPI data. The S&P up more than 1%, closing at another record high. The Dow up more than 200 points. And the tech bounce fueling Nasdaq's gain, jumping over 1.5%. Some energy names hitting all-time highs. Diamondback Energy, Marathon Petroleum, and Valero all trading near those levels. Well, healthcare having a strong start to the year with the XLV gaining nearly 8% since January and 0.5% today. As Wall Street mulls President Biden's newly released election year budget, the proposal designating $130 billion to the Department of Health and Human Services, protecting Medicare funding and lowering prescription drugs costs if approved. Joining us here on set to go inside the proposal is Dr. Kavita Patel, NBC News and MSNBC medical contributor. Welcome, Dr. Patel.
Clap her in. Come on. It's rarefied air now.
It really is. Some of these proposals are very interesting and I'm sure would appeal to many Americans who are facing high drug costs, namely the $2,000 cap, which would be applied to all insured Americans, which seems amazing from this standpoint.
It is.
Consumer standpoint, but not so for the drug companies.
Not so for the drug companies, Melissa. And I think, obviously, we have to even see how the initial 10 drugs that were being priced by Medicare play out. We want to make sure that they do deliver on that out-of-pocket cost reduction. But we won't know until we see the prices and how much of that. Remember, it's not just about the drug manufacturer. There's all these kind of people in the middle involved with drugs and the out-of-pocket costs. But it's still a signal from the Biden administration that they know this is popular and that expanding this, not just to broader markets beyond Medicare, is something that voters want. So you're seeing a rehash of some of the more popular initiatives in 2022 playing out in 2024.
Amazing to have you on, Doctor. So, you know, years ago, there was a huge bullseye, always in political presidential campaigns, on big cap pharma's back. But the market seems to have sniffed out all bark and no bite.
Right.
Is that an accurate assessment of what's going on here?
I think that it's an accurate assessment that we won't know what the bark kind of is and how it matches the bite until we see those prices playing out, which we will know in September of this year. So we'll have some critical milestones in the last quarter of 2024. And I think that could shape a lot of how much of the bite there is. What I will say is that if no matter whether the president's budget goes into place or just what's in law, we will still have, at some point, every drug in Medicare eventually will be on this list. So at the end of the day, Medicare price negotiation and drug negotiation is real. Add to that states trying to do reimportation, Colorado, other places. The pressure on pharma is real, and we're seeing it in the early venture space. You're seeing a change in how early venture funds are investing in biotech because they don't know if big pharma will still be able to kind of invest in them. So those things, I think, have cycled out. Still a very good space for the obesity drugs, though, because it looks like Medicare could pick up one of those drugs for coverage now that it has a cardiac indication, namely Ozempic. So that's a big deal.
So getting to a place where, you know, the Biden 10, you could make an argument that if you're early stage enough, if you're these drugs are not early stage. But at some point, do you see companies opting out of being in the Medicare market, period? And I'm thinking about GLP-1, the profitability in here now is they don't care.
Right.
And this is, as you said, this is populist rhetoric, at least for now. So I'm just curious how you see this. And this is the administration that's talking about the cancer moonshot. I mean, how are you going to get companies to get there if you do this?
And you see a little bit of crumbs in the budget for things like kind of cancer moonshot. They're talking about just amending exclusivity so that they can have more of that kind of safe harbor, if you will, for skinny labels. They're doing some things, adding research funding. I think they're trying to say, like, look, we want to negotiate on price, but we're also going to try to create some incentives down line for these types of drugs. But I think you're right that I think manufacturers are having to make a decision. These 10 have all been very clear. They do not want to be out of the Medicare space. Who would want to if you're in this market? Medicare is such a large payer. And as Medicare goes, so go the other things. And that's why you see the president extending the Medicare insulin caps to the commercial market. So you're seeing this very familiar pattern. So to get out of Medicare would be a pretty devastating. That would be a lot of bite for the bark, I think.
You mentioned early stage money reevaluating how they invest.
Right.
That seems like it would have tremendous repercussions, not maybe immediately, but maybe 5 years down the line. In what way are they changing how they, you know, invest and where they put their money?
Yeah, it's interesting. The National, Melissa, the National Venture Capital Association has done a survey. They've actually now done it 2 years in a row, I think, in leading up to the IRA and also since the IRA to try to understand where early stage investors are changing or thinking differently. They have all said, I think, majority of the early stage investors in biotech have said that they're trying to think very carefully about whether orphan labels or kind of rare disease indications, thinking about what the drugs that are potentially being funded and whether or not that would be kind of a more narrow indication, what that would mean for Medicare. Because if you have something that's rare or more narrow, that was normally a way to get in kind of on the early FDA breakthrough designation, kind of accelerated approvals. But eventually you wanted a larger commercial play. That designation might not protect you from price negotiation necessarily. So that's the kind of thinking you're seeing. However, do not mistake, there's still a lot of investments, especially in the incretin space, this GLP-1 space, neurodegenerative diseases, huge opportunity. And I still think there's still enough in cancer. It's just that cancer is a big space and a big number of diseases that come under there. But it's still something investors are talking about, and 2 years ago they weren't.
And just quickly, because we're out of time, but what is the one drug with the company that investors are sort of not paying attention to, but doctors are?
Ooh, this is the test of.
It's not a test of stock picking because it's just a drug.
No.
Developed by a public company,
right?
That you're excited about for your patients.
Yeah. No. So I know that we've had some of the problems with the ALS drugs and Amylyx. There's certainly enough reasons that data was not sufficient. But I do think that space and kind of the technology and using something that can be like very exciting for nerve stimulation, for ALS, for other neurodegenerative diseases is incredibly exciting. And to make a tech pivot, I think that space with like brain computer stimulation and using that with molecules is something that we're all very excited about. And many of those companies, public now, are in early stages for that.
Dr. Patel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hope to see you here on set.
100%.
Again.
Regular, I think, now. Official.
V-Scheme, which is your acronym.
Yes.
I use that term loosely. H is healthcare, right?
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. And I do think healthcare, you absolutely want to be in this space. And Guy, I think you bring up something interesting. This is always a political football. We are in an election year. Mm-hmm. And I think you are going to see this spoken of a lot more this year. But this is one of those rare times where we've actually had both of these candidates. I mean, I don't know if we officially know that in office, where we've seen what they've done in the healthcare space and people are not concerned about it. And I think you do want to be in that space. I don't think that the politics should weigh into that currently.
Pretty good desk side manner, wouldn't you say?
Desk
from Dr.
Manner,
Patel?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's it. That's all I got.
That's all you have?
Yeah.
I'm shocked that somebody of that high I'm not casting aspersions to our normal audience, but
somebody who can actually save lives would bother watching Fast Money.
Precisely.
Let me make a real comment then. I think ultimately what we're hearing from Dr. Patel is that even some of the big pharma names that haven't been participating have significant investment in some cutting edge technologies.
Yeah.
You know the names. I won't name them.
Coming up, inside the shadowy world of organized retail crime, as CNBC gets exclusive access to how thieves steal millions of dollars in items that end up for sale online. A CNBC investigation, Selling Stolen, is next.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Organized crime rings that target the country's retailers are prompting an aggressive nationwide crackdown by law enforcement. In a CNBC exclusive, we go inside the criminal police investigations that target the theft rings who set up thriving businesses to steal and sell online. Here's Courtney Reagan with Selling Stolen.
It's a chilly, clear morning in the picturesque foothills of San Diego County as we head to a suspected crime scene. A convoy of law enforcement vehicles is about to descend on an unlikely place, a mansion complete with its own vineyard and chapel rented out as a wedding venue and Airbnb. Police believe it's also the headquarters for a lucrative theft ring where items stolen from Ulta Beauty Supply and other retailers are being resold on Amazon. As we pull up, authorities tell us they have the suspected ringleader in handcuffs.
What are we looking for?
There they are, right there. Okay, okay.
And it's happening everywhere. For months, we got exclusive access to the California Highway Patrol, watching up close how it fights organized retail crime, which, including external theft, totaled $40.5 billion in the U.S., according to the National Retail Federation's most recent estimate. On another day, in another California city, we see more truckloads of what police say is stolen clothing, mostly from TJ Maxx.
We have a search warrant for the resident. Come on, with your hands up now.
I think people feel like it's hopeless. I want the retailers and the victims of this to know that that's not true.
Hands on your head.
Retailers specifically pointing to theft as a growing problem in recent years include Target, Foot Locker, Walgreens, and Ulta. But few quantify the impact or offer many details, raising questions in the industry about whether retailers are using the attention around theft to cover their own operational missteps.
The woman arrested, Michelle Mack, and her husband, Kenneth, have pled not guilty to conspiracy and theft charges. An Amazon spokesperson said, quote, "We invest more than $1 billion annually and employ thousands of people to fight fraud." The company added that it uses sophisticated detection and prevention solutions, allowing us to quickly spot a range of organized retail crime schemes. Amazon acknowledged, in this case, we did not receive signals to identify the seller was engaged in selling stolen goods. As far as TJ Maxx, the company tells us it's laser focused on fighting retail crime in its stores. There is so much more on CNBC.com and CNBC's YouTube channel. The full piece is about 17 minutes. We were able to follow a number of cases and stings. The one here we profiled, obviously, most of those goods were beauty products being stolen from Ulta and then resold on Amazon. It happened over a decade, over $8 million worth of goods. And when we were there, they pulled out $387,000 worth of goods that were stolen mostly, again, from Ulta.
Back when a lot of these retailers had inventory overhangs, this seemed to be a oft-cited issue. And more recently, it's not. So what do you make of that? Is it that they're getting better at combating, or the problem just sort of goes away because maybe it was, as you mentioned, just a cover-up for their operational
issues? It's such a good question, and that is what has become really hard about this, is it's really hard to nail down a number and to figure out the trend. Is it increasing? Is it just happening during certain times when there's other inventory missteps happening? There's more online. I was able to speak with Ulta Beauty CEO Dave Kimball, really in a first-of-its-kind interview. We talked for 45 minutes about only organized retail crime, and he said, for us, it is accelerating. It is a bigger problem, and it seems to be getting worse. They're doing things like locking up 100% of fragrances in all of their stores, which is a big deal, right? But the rest of the makeup is out to explore and test because that's sort of the business model. He says he visits stores. It is the number one question that he gets from employees is what can we do to help combat this theft? So he acknowledges for him and for his business, it is a bigger problem. Yeah. California Highway Patrol, they have seen arrests go up. The cases that they're following, more than 100%. Homeland Security told us the same thing. So, you know, at least the arrests and the caseload seem to be going up. In aggregate, is it all going up? We just don't know. A lot of it's underreported. And in a number of the cases that we followed, Ulta, for example, is the one that sort of began aggregating the data to then give to the police for them to investigate. It took them a year, for instance, for this one. TJ Maxx, similarly, the asset protection officers were on the ground to identify those goods, and they were the ones that had to begin to build the case for law enforcement. So a number of these also end up going underreported. It's just really hard to know.
Courtney, thank you. Great work.
Thanks.
Courtney Reagan. Check it out on our YouTube channel and CNBC.com. Coming up, a technical turnaround. One of our traders seeing some bullish signs in Deutsche Bank's chart, the lines and levels that could point to more gains ahead. More Fast Money in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of Deutsche Bank popping 4% in U.S. trading today. The long beaten down German financial is now up nearly 20% from its February lows. Dan thinks this could be a breakout. We haven't mentioned this one in years, probably.
And I don't think we've said anything nice about it in a decade. honest with you, and I'm going to channel my Tim Seymour and my Carter Braxton Worth here, because I know this is, likes the Euro banks. I know he's an exposure in some of his ETFs. I just say this, and Carter, from a technical perspective, he's got us all focused on these bearish to bullish sort of reversals. Just look at this one-year chart. I was just kind of going through a bunch of charts. I saw the headline today about cost cutting. I saw the way the stock reacted. I was looking at it yesterday, actually, just breaking out above that kind of little base that it's been making here in that little flag. Now look at a 20-year log chart, and this is the one. And you look at this and you see if there's anything decent going on there fundamentally. You know what I'm saying? From a technical perspective, this stock's got a lot of room to run. So, again, channeling my Fast Money co-panelists here, I don't know. It looks kind of interesting.
All right. Up next, final trades. Final trade time, Tim.
Look at the European market breaking out. The Fez, and that's the Euro Stoxx 50, whatever you're playing, breaking out.
Courtney?
Coming back to the beginning of the show, I like this. Return to hardware, old school tech. I think Dell is a name to take a look at.
Dan?
Yeah, I'd say IDVO. That's Ampli International Enhanced Dividend ETF. It's got a lot of banking exposure internationally.
If Riedel's still watching, that stuff better be in the mail. Like, I'm just telling you.
Delicate to be in the mail. You have a trade?
ALK, Mel.
All right, thanks for watching Fast. Mad Money starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.